ಭದ್ರಂ ಕರುಣೇತಿ ಶ್ರೀಯಾಮಹೇ ವಾಹ ಭದ್ರಂ ಪಶ್ಯೇಮಾಕ್ಷಧೀರ್ಯಚಂದ್ರಾಃ ಕಿರೈರಂಗೈಃ ಸುಶುಭಾಂಸಸ್ತನೂಭಿಃ ಯಶೇನ ದೇವಹಿ ಸಂಯತಾಯುಃ ಸ್ವಸ್ತಿನ ಇಂದ್ರೋ ವೃದ್ಧಶ್ರವಾಃ ಸ್ವಸ್ತಿನ ಪೂಷಾ ವಿಶ್ವವೇದಾಃ ಸ್ವಸ್ತಿನಃ ಸಾರಸೋ ಅರಿಷ್ಟನೇಃ ಸ್ವಸ್ತಿನೋ ಬೃಹಸ್ಪತಿರ್ಭವತು. ಓಂ ಶಾಂತಿ ಶಾಂತಿ ಶಾಂತಿ.
Let's chant from the Karma Na together. So we get down to the last two lines that we're going to do.
Na karma na na prajaya kane na tyage na ite amritam vama na shuhu pade na natam nikitam guhayam dhikha chate yantyatayo vishanti Vedanta Vijnana Sunishti Karantha Sanyasa Yoga Yataya Shuddha Tattva Aha Te Brahma Loke Tu Para Anta Kale Para Amrita Parimushan Chitarve.
Okay, those last two lines are where we left off. The Yeti, so I'm going just back a few lines just to bring us to connect with this from the Lord. The Yeti's means the sannyasis. The sannyasis who have, take the sannyasis as the ones who have what we call vidvat sannyasa. The sannyasis, vidvat sannyasa means sarva karma sannyasa. Those sannyasis who have, are sannyasis in terms of their knowledge. In terms of lifestyle, there's two types of sannyasas. There's the vividisha sannyasa. Those who take sannyasa, they take the orange in order to gain this knowledge. They're mumukshus. And they're ready to take sannyasa. They have already accomplished that karma yoga buddhi. They're ready to take sannyasa, that would lead that renunciate life, so that they can spend their time studying this knowledge, spend their life of contemplation, and where they expose themselves to this life of teaching and contemplation. And so that's the vividisha sannyasa, one who actually lives a renunciate life in order to gain this knowledge. Then there's the vidvat sannyasa. The vidvat sannyasa is the one who's a sannyasa by their knowledge, because of their knowledge. And that, in fact, is really the sannyasi. The vividisha sannyasa, the one who's taking the orange, living a renunciate life, in order to gain knowledge, actually wants to become the vidvat sannyasa, the one who is the one who has recognized their true nature. That's the sannyasi, the one who has recognized their true nature. And for that sannyasi, the one who has recognized their true nature through knowledge, right, because of their knowledge, they're now awake to their true nature. So they say here, taking this as vidvat sannyasa, they say that sannyasi who is shuddha sattvaha, that sannyasi who has antakarana shuddhi, who has a mind which is pure. A mind which is pure means a mind that's free of raga dvesha, a mind that's free of these likes and dislikes, a mind that is not critical, a mind that we evoke at the time when we sit for meditation. That's what we were doing in the meditation, and we'll see it in this next verse also that we're going to be going into, where they're actually teaching meditation. What we just did in the meditation today was actually to invoke in ourselves that sannyasi mind, a mind that approaches the world with a state of abhayam. Abhayam means free from fear, In fact, every sannyasi, when they take the orange, they take this major sannyasa vow, is may I not be afraid of you, and may you not be afraid of me. May I not be someone who invokes fear. Yeah. May I not be afraid of you, and may you not be afraid of me. So it's so beautiful, and we can appreciate that particular vow, how beautiful that is just in terms of our relationship with others. And to meet a person like that, a Swami, a person who really is a sannyasi, who when you're in the presence of that person, they have no fear of you. That means there's nothing about you that they're afraid of. There's nothing about you that they have a need to reject or pull away from or push away. Right? So, abhayam. They accept you as you are and want to help. If there's a problem or something, if you have something that you're working on or something that's causing you pain or some irritant, if there's not bhaya. There's not, oh no, you're like that, so pushing you. That's not, that there's not there. That there's friendship and wanting to help. And so, you also, so you don't feel, because they're not afraid of you, you also feel no fear from them. Because they're not in competition with you, they're not rejecting you, they're not harming you, or there's nothing in them that wants to hurt you. And so when we're around a person like that, even if it's temporarily, say with your partner or your family or somebody's in that disposition, even if it's time-bound, if they're in that disposition, you know, that's very, very pleasing. It's very, very relaxing on a deep level. Your being can relax on a deep level because there's no attack, you know. That which we can appreciate so well in terms of our relationship to the world, you know, we need to appreciate and value internally also the way that we are toward ourself, toward our mind, toward our emotions, toward our complexes, toward our inadequacies, toward our failures, toward our, you know, foot in the mouth time. But all of these things, all the whatever we are in our totality, the sannyasa attitude means we, the inner witness, the observing ego, we can say, you know, the buddhi, holds that, all of those parts of myself in this state of abhayam, where I don't, all these different parts of myself and all of the parts of my unconscious, as we'll see, as we're going to be working on meditation after this text in the next probably few weeks, for the next, over the next several weeks, all of these parts of myself, trust me, are not afraid of me, you know? And I'm not afraid of them. That's the key also. I can be afraid of myself. You know, I'm acting in this way, or I'm misbehaving in this way, or, you know, creating this problem for myself, or oh, I haven't matured in this area. All these are all that the inner critic can come. Oh my God, you haven't matured in this area. You're causing this problem and that problem, and are you ever going to get better? You know, that's a fear. You become afraid of yourself because of, you're not living up to your expectations, or will you wonder if the mind or your emotions or your complexes ever will mature? So you become afraid of them, you know, afraid of them and rejecting toward them and critical of them. All this critic and all of this stuff is fear. Fear. So you have to be different or I won't be happy. That's the fear. That's the bhayam. Bhayam means fear. I'm afraid of you because if you continue on like this, I won't be able to be happy. That's it. That's the fear, right? And so, if I'm afraid of you, meaning all of these different parts of myself, then how do you think those parts will feel toward me, the one who's afraid of them? Rejected. Rejected and pushed away and not able to relax. You know, it's like sometimes it's good to imagine all of these different parts of yourself that are getting in trouble in one way or another, or getting hurting themselves in one way or another as your child, you know. And if the parent comes as a critical, you know, as a critic, then the child just becomes more and more, you know, afraid and withdrawn. But if the parent comes as somebody who is loving and helping and caring and wants to make things better, then that child can relax. You know, because parent wants to help and love. The child can relax. It's natural. It's like that in the world also. You know, you go to your boss and your boss wants, loves you and cares about you and respects you and wants to help. You can relax and try to work on the problem. If the boss is critical, you know, and ready to fire you if you raise your eyebrow incorrectly, you know, then you contract. And so all of this, what's true in the external world is true in the internal world. So in the wonderful thing is it's kind of, as we start talking about it, it's a no-brainer in a way. I mean, nobody's going to say, oh, no, it's not really like that. Well, because it obviously is like that. We know it. We know it just from our life experience. And so you can take the life experience that you know so well in terms of the world, and then it makes sense to understand that it's not any different internally. What's wonderful, though, is that in the internal world, we have more control. In a way, it's easier, once we understand, it's easier in the internal world to invoke that inner friend, you know, because we have control of it. And it's easier to have the immediate experience of the ones whom the inner friend has been invoked toward. We have an immediate, what do you call it, an immediate effect. Mm-hmm. And we get the immediate result of that, you know, because the part that's hurt, or the part that's in trouble, or the part that is worried will relax. You know, and so you feel, as you work with this internally, you feel that your inner environment starts to change, you know, because there's care. And so, I mean, we know this, even a word like love is kind of a cliche word, but we all know that it's true. You know, it's really the love that we're all seeking, and it's love that relaxes us, it's love that heals everything, you know, and we have to learn simply. It's very simple. We know that in terms of the world, but we forget that we are part of the world. Right? We're also part of the world. The unconscious is part of the world. My thoughts are part of the world. My mistakes are part of the world. My shortcomings are part of the world, as much as, you know, as much as the rest of the world. And so as we make this very, what I'd say, very simple adjustment, what happens is that we are invoking inside the vows of sannyasa. That is the sannyasi that we're invoking. The sannyasi is the one who gives abhayam to the world, and in order for that abhayam to be complete, the individual has to be included in it. The buddhi of the sannyasi gives abhayam, that fearlessness, the protection to the world, you know. And in doing that, the buddhi gives it to the body, mind, sense, so it's complex also. So that's the sannyasa buddhi. And so for the vidvat sannyasi, the one who has this knowledge, it's that vidvat sannyasa, you know, that you don't have to be, that's what the vidvat sannyasi is working for, the one who's taken the orange, that's what the karma yogi is working for, that mumukshu is working for. And when we sit in meditation, we have an opportunity to, because in meditation we slow everything down, right? We slow everything down and we get a quiet space for ourselves. We can invoke in ourselves the sannyasi. And that's what we actually do. We become Kshatriya Brahmanishtha. We evoke that firmness of knowledge in that moment of meditation. So here, the yetis, these sadhus who have shuddha sattva, who have a mind, you know, which is pure. Pure, it means this. That inner friend is there. It's free of raga dvesha. It's free of all of these likes and dislikes. It's free of the criticism. It has that stance of abhayam. That's the sattva shuddhi. So that mind is a very quiet mind. So here it says, in these two lines, the yeti, the sannyasi, who has this pure mind. Why? Because of this sannyasa yoga. sannyasa yoga, because of the sannyasa yoga, because of the sannyasa buddhi, which is what? The abhayam. You know, it's the buddhi which has vairagya. If see, it's vairagya means dispassion. I accept you as you are, I want to help. That's vairagya. Accept you as you are, which how can I help? It's not that the lack of vairagya is, I don't accept you as you are. I don't accept you as you are, whether it be a physical situation, whether it be your humans or animals or anything in the world, I don't accept you as you are, because if you behave that way or if this is happening, I won't be happy. So in that area, there's no vairagya. Vairagya is I accept you as you are. And then let me help. Doesn't mean I accept you as you are and everything's miserable, so don't go on. Accept you as you are, there's a problem here, let me help. That's freedom, that's abhayam. So that's that sannyasa buddhi. It's really beautiful. That's the sannyasa. What we need, we're not going to, here in the West, most of us aren't going to take the orange. We don't need to take orange. That's better off, you're better off being an Indian in India taking orange, because the sannyasa vows are, they exist within a particular cultural context. It's more difficult for us to take those type of vows here in terms of actually living that lifestyle, because the culture doesn't support the lifestyle. But the vows by guna, by quality, by understanding, by jnana, those are natural for us. Therefore, if you're mumukshu, you'll end up taking those vows internally. They become your sadhana. That becomes who you are. You are a sannyasi, in fact. As you gain knowledge, you become more and more of a sannyasi. Means you're owning up the reality of sannyasa, which is the recognition of yourself. And the recognition of yourself, there's a way, there's an attitude that you of abhayam that you have toward the world. So there's a lot to say for that. We'll be really looking at that in these next few verses. But so here, this yeti who has the sannyasi, that the sannyasa buddhi, buddhi means that mindset. The buddhi has a lot of meanings. It can mean that the knowledge that you have, it's the knowledge that you, that what, how your intellect is the buddhi. The intellect is where, is what holds the knowledge. So the buddhi with the ahankara, the I notion, is also part of the buddhi, part of the intellect. But the intellect is your knowledge basis. The intellect is the one who has knowledge managing the manas, managing the mind, which is where all of the kind of the emotions are held. And so the buddhi is the one that has some objectivity. The buddhi is the one that can be overwhelmed by the manas, overwhelmed by the mind, overwhelmed by the emotions. But it's the buddhi then that has to say, that'll say, I'm overwhelmed by these emotions. Yeah, it's making a knowledge statement. The buddhi is the one that has clarity about the situation. It may be overwhelmed, you know, and it may misbehave also because of its lack of clarity of understanding. It may be overwhelmed by likes and dislikes and whatnot. But the buddhi is the one that is the decision maker, right? And so that buddhi is the, we can say the buddhi also is the knowledge. The one who has that buddhi, one that has that knowledge, is the one that is the sannyasi, right? So the buddhi, your buddhi becomes a sannyasi. Whether you're taking the orange or not, as your buddhi matures, you become a such sannyasi, you become a vairagi. And so here, because of that sannyasa, there's the shuddha sattva, there's that purity of mind. And that sannyasa, because of the sannyasa, and what is it that gives that knowledge, the Vedanta, Jnana, Nishtitartaha, those yetis are ones for whom the understanding, the artha, is sunishchita, is completely clear. Vidajnanam means there's firmness of knowledge. For that sannyasi, their knowledge is firm. What is the knowledge? The knowledge brought about by the vijnanam of the Vedanta. The vijnanam is the aparoksha jnanam, means the direct, immediate knowledge that through the teaching tradition, through the sampradaya, the teaching methodology of the Vedanta, the Upanishads, that vijnanam, that direct, immediate knowledge, is clearly gained without any doubt. Sunishchitartha, right? The Vedanta vijnanam, the direct, immediate knowledge, is something which is clearly, fully understood for those yetis, for those sannyasis who have purity of mind, that is brought about through the Vairagya, right? Through the sannyasa yoga, that is the maturation, that is the natural point of maturation for this knowledge. Because once with this knowledge, once you know I am the ananda, I am the wholeness that I seek, okay, then I can gain vairagya. If I don't know that I'm the wholeness that I seek, then I can gain partial vairagya, because we all have partial vairagya. I don't want this and I don't want that. You know? In fact, 99.99999% of everything in this creation, you are a vairagi. You're a sannyasi, perfect. But there's this little handful of things where there's no vairagya. Right? There's no vairagya. I need those things to be, I need those things, I need them to be in a particular way in order for me to be happy. Right? But those are the things that I also grow out of, because those objects are also the attachment that I put onto those objects, and the expectations, especially people, the expectations I put on my partners and my children and my loved ones, you know, so that I can be happy, is something just awful. It's awful for all involved. You know, it's awful for, say, in a dyad, a couple. It's awful for both. You know, I need you to be this way, and so I'm unhappy. And the partner says, you need me to be this way, and I'm not, so I'm miserable too. So we're both miserable, you know. You need me to be this way, and so I'm always having to try to live up to being that way, so I don't feel free. And then I'm miserable, you're making me unhappy all the time because you're not able to live up to the way that I want you to be. And so you get into this web of dukkha, this web of sorrow. And so, in fact, what Swamiji sometimes will joke, he said that, you know, the greatest one to have a relationship with is the Swami. You know, it's the sannyasi, because they will let you be as you are. And the great thing about being a jnani, about gaining knowledge, is because the more knowledge I gain, the more anicca I gain in my knowledge, the more freedom I give to everybody that knows me. And all those people will really start liking me much more. because I'm not, you know, squeezing them. You're not wringing out the ananda, trying to wring out some ananda from them. And that's how they feel. They feel wrung out. You know? And we feel wrung out too. So to the degree that abhayam is a beautiful word. You know, that abhayam is the word for sannyasa, that fearlessness. That you not be afraid of me and me not be afraid of you. It means I can appreciate and enjoy you as you are, and if there's a problem I can help. That's such freedom. I can only have that freedom, though, to the degree that is meaningful, is if I myself am the source of ananda that I seek. If there's any dvaita, if there's any duality at all between my being and the ananda that I seek, then I'm different from the ananda and I need it. And then all of the samsara comes. So the sannyasi is the one who has recognized nishtitartaha with a firmly dridhajnana means knowledge which is clear without any doubt. The mind has owned it up. That's the Vedanta Vijnana Sunishtitartaha. Those people are, with the purity of mind, sannyasa yoga, those people, what about them? Going at the previous verse, those yetis, they enter into that cave of the heart, you know, that which is located in the cave of the heart, which is Parenanakam, which is the higher than heaven, which is greater than heaven. Why? Because when you think of going to heaven, even in the West, we think going to heaven, then finally you're happy. Finally, you know, you get your way and there's happiness there. You know, but in India, when we think of Swargaloka, see, in India, when you think of Swargaloka going to heaven, it's temporary. You go to heaven to stay there for a while based upon your karma, but eventually you'll come back. So even though it's wonderful, wonderful while you're there, you know, it's still relative, and of course you can be in a little higher position in the lokas in that world than you are. But nevertheless, it's pretty good. But it is time bound. This is Parenanakam. It is not time bound. The very source of the ananda that is enjoyed in the Swarga Loka, that ananda you are. And that ananda is free from time. It's timeless. And so because of that, it's superior to the ananda in Swarga Loka, because it's the very self. It's the very source of the ananda that's enjoyed in Swarga Loka and in all different lokas, in all different worlds. And so in that way, it's superior. And where is it located? Nita Guhayam. It's located right here in my buddhi, in the guha, in the cave of my buddhi. It's sitting right here. The yetis, the sannyasis, the ones who have this knowledge, they enter there. It's like the buddhi, I, this ananda, the ananda, the self that I am sitting in the buddhi. I am the self of the buddhi, and I'm the conscious being that lights up the buddhi, the mind. I'm the conscious being whose very nature is ananda that lights up the mind. But because of ajnanam, because of ignorance, this buddhi looks out this way instead of recognizing the self that is its own being, right? And so it's as though hidden in the buddhi. That's why they say it's hidden in the guha, the cave of the buddhi. It's like way down deep there somehow, hidden in the darkness. Hidden in the darkness because covered by ajnanam, covered by ignorance. And so because of the Vedanta Vijnanam, the clarity of knowledge, the aproksha jnanam, the direct immediate knowledge, right, that takes place at the time of teaching, so, and because of their maturity, their vairagya, because they have that vairagya, that dispassion, their mind isn't pulled out anymore, and so it just sits there in that ananda, which is seated in the cave of the buddhi. That's what they enter, it says. And then it says, those te brahmalokeshu parantakale paramrtat parimuchante sarve. It says, then all of them, all of the jnanis, those sannyasis who have this, are brahmanishtas, all of these who have this clarity of knowledge, then it says, then in that brahmaloka, that loka which is Brahman, the loka which is Brahman, means the Brahman which is the infinite conscious being that I am in that brahmaloka, parantakale, at this final moment of death, I'll tell you what parant, let me just do that now. Antakala means the final moment. When a person dies, that's the last time, that's the last. Kala means fine, a time. Anta means end. At the end of your time here, for instance, is antakala. So when the body drops, that's antakala. So when your body drops, that's the last moment of this body. But then you transmigrate and take another body. Okay, so it's not the final moment, really. It's just the final moment of this body because you're going to come around again. That's antakala. Parantakala is different than that. That's the supreme end. That's the end of the ego. That's the end of the ahankara. Because at the time of knowledge, when knowledge takes place, that clarity, sunishtitartaha, when that clarity of knowledge takes place, then what happens is that the ahankara, the I notion that had been misidentified, that because of ajnanam, because of ignorance, the ahankara has taken the atma, Brahman, has taken your being, the satchitananda, the fullness of your being, and misidentified it with your body, mind, sense organs, and so you've become a limited entity. You take the atma, the self that you are, which is in truth Brahman, to be this. And then when this dies, you die. According to, because of your ajnanam, that's what you think. It doesn't happen. You must be very shocked every time the body dies. Oh, I didn't die after all. And how many times, beginningless births and deaths. So every time, oh, thank goodness, I don't really die. Oh, thank goodness, I don't really die. Over and over. What a torture. They even use this example of samsara, of a person being caught in the tidal wave and in the ocean with the undertow. They're out in the ocean, they went out too far, and now they're caught in the undertow. So they get pushed up pulled down. Pushed up, they get a breath, pulled down. Pushed up, pulled down. Pushed up, pulled down. At first they think, pulled down again. And push up, thank God. And then, you know, after 10, 15 times, you're pushed up and you think, that's the samsara. You get sick of it after a while. You become a mumukshu finally. Become a mumukshu because now, I don't die. I don't die. I don't die. How many times have we gone through this? You know? Even in terms of your lifetime, during the lifetime, every time the dukkha occurs, you're pulled under the water. You know, you're pulled under the water and then you come up and you think, oh, thank God. And it's a really interesting thing. Swamiji will do the joke, sukha, dukkha. Sukha, dukkha, sukha, dukkha. Sukha, dukkha. But it is like that. When you're down in the dukkha, you don't know if the sukha will come again. You're in the unhappiness pit. You don't know if you'll be happy again. It's scary. You know, it's scary when you're down in the dukkha. But when you're up in the sukha, you don't have that problem. You know it's not going to last. Right? Isn't that funny? You know it's not going to last, and that immediately brings sorrow, and you're on your way down. And in the dukkha, you don't know when you're going to come up. It's very, very interesting. But that's the nature of samsara. That's the birth, death, birth, death, birth, death, birth, death. Sukha dukkha, sukha dukkha, sukha dukkha. And then on a physical level, the truth of it, birth, death, birth, death, birth, birth, death. So there's no relief. That's the antikala. You know, that's the situation that a jiva has. Parantikala is different than that. Parantikala is when the misidentification has been, the ajnanam has been removed, that has caused you to superimpose your being that actually never goes through any samsara at all. Consciousness never goes through samsara. There's not an up and a down to consciousness. There's not an up and a down to the ananda, which is your own swarupa, to your being, to the ananda, the satchit ananda, the conscious being that you are. There's no up or down. There's no change. It's timeless. But your being is so totally identified by the mind with the body-mind-sense complex that you take all of the experiences of the body-mind-sense organs to be you. And of course, they're treacherous. I mean, this body gets old and dies. It gets old and dies. It's not that fun. It gets sick, you know? And unless you have tremendous punya and you live a very healthy life and drop dead like that, you consider great punya to have an easy death. You know, but so say you were so lucky as to have a very healthy body and a quick death. That's tremendous punya for this physical body, you know. But you still are going to die, and you're not, right? And then with the mind is, you know, as long as there's ajnana there's going to be a superimposition of your ananda upon certain objects in the world that you then have to go after. And that's also a huge problem because you don't have control over anything that is not you. You know? So you can grab onto it and it can be taken away. You know? And unfortunately, you can also grab onto it and then change your mind and not want it anymore and then you have it. We experience all of these different variations of dukkha around the attainment of sukha, right? Around our attainment of sukha, this projection of ananda onto the world, we continually experience different forms of dukkha around it. So parantikala is when the ajnana has been removed, the ignorance has been removed, and the ahankara, the I notion, now resolves into my own being. The ahankara, as long as you have this physical body, that's part of empirical reality, it's part of Ishwara now, it's been born. This body will last until the karma, the karmas that brought it here run out. This body will be here. The I notion will be here, the mind will be here, everything will be here. But the ajnana, the ignorance that had caused the subjective suffering, that won't be here. The ignorance that's responsible for the ahankar, the misidentification of myself with these various conditioning agents like the body, mind, sense organs, that ajnana is no more. And so the self that I am is the self that I am. The self that which is Brahman, the truth of myself, is the truth that I am. The buddhi recognizes it. The ahankara recognizes it, right? The ahankara now is filled with knowledge. The I notion just becomes mithya. It means it becomes just something that is functional. It's a functional ahankara, so that I don't have to talk like saying, you know, the eyes are seeing now, and the body is walking to the store, and the mind is feeling such and such. I can talk normally, so I can use the eye as a normal person. So it just becomes a word that I use to identify, to use for the body, or for the sense organs, or the mind, like an ajnana uses. But for me, it's mithya. It's not that I now become the body. If I say I'm walking to the store, it's not like, oh, all of a sudden now I've become the body and I'm walking to the store. I'm always me. I'm always the self. Because that ajnana has been removed, nothing can bring that ajnana back. That's the parantakala. That's the supreme end, the final end. So at this final end, then what? All of these jnanis, these ones who have this sunishthitartha, all of these Vedanta Vijnana Sunishthitartha, the Yatiyaha, the Siddha Sattvaha, all of these people who have this Jnana Nishtha, all of them, they parimuchanti, they are completely liberated. Without pari means on all the way around. You know pari, when we use that as an upasarga? It means you take the verb like much to liberate. Pari means all the way around you're liberated. It means there's no place that where you're stuck. It's complete. You are completely liberated. Now this can be paramrita or it can be paramritaha. Paramritaha means that the ones who are immortal completely, because they are Brahman. Amrita means immortal, free from death. They are paramritaha. They are completely free from death. They are completely liberated. Free from death at this end time, because of the elimination of the ego, right, of the ahankara, all of them abide. All of them are there in Brahmaloka. How are they there in Brahmaloka? In Brahman, which is in the world, which is Brahman, they are there in that. Means that the ahankara, the one that used to be out here in this, is now resolved into the self that I am. So that is the freedom. That is the moksha. There's another way of interpreting these last two lines that I'm just going to tell you, because you can read either interpretation. We use the first one usually, the one that I just told you. But this one, where you take the paramrita, we can say that those jnanis, all jnanis are liberated to have this clarity of knowledge, are at the end of the kalpa, of Brahmaji's kalpa, all are liberated. There can be some that, because of paribandhakas, because of certain obstructions or desires or things that are getting in the way, instead of having what we call jivan mukti, where they're liberated while living, there's what's called krama mukti, where they go up into Swargaloka, and they stay there till the end of the kalpa, and then at that time they're liberated because they have certain paribandhakas. And so at the end of the kalpa, they will reside in Brahmaloka until the end of the kalpa, means the end of the projection of the creation. As long as Brahmaji is there, they'll be there, and then at that time they'll be liberated. But we don't usually take that meaning from the Vedantic perspective. But for Sanskrit students, if you do take it, word Brahmaloka is a Tatpurusha, can be, you know, the loka of Brahman, the loka of Brahmaji. Or it can be a Karmadarya, the loka which is Brahman, right? The loka which is Brahman, or the loka of Brahman. Loka of Brahman is the loka of Brahmaji. So you can take it like that. They say in liberation, moksha, there can be two types of moksha, jivan mukta. That means that at the time in this life itself, you have clarity of knowledge, there's nothing left over, there's no paribandhakas or anything. And so when this body drops, at that time you just abide as the whole, as Ishwar. Right? Or because of certain paribandhakas, obstructions, when this body drops, there'll be purification, that takes place, and you'll go to Brahmaloka, you know, stay in Brahmaloka till the end of the kalpa, and at that time, when Brahmaji, when this manifestation goes into unmanifest condition, at that time you'd be liberated along with Brahmaji. Just so that you know, in case you didn't know. Okay. Let's read this next one, and then it's too late for us to do it, but since I baseline meditation on it, I want to at least read the verse, okay? And we'll spend all next week on this verse, okay? Vivekta deshe chasukasanastaha. Vivekta deshe chasukasanastaha. Sachisamas griva shirashariraha. Chichisamas griva shirashariraha. Achashramasta sakalendriyani. Achashramasta sakalendriyani. Nirujya bhaktya swagurum pranamya. Nirujya bhaktya swagurum pranamya. Vivikta deshe cha sukha asana staha. Suchihi sama griva shiras shariraha. Atyashrama staha sakala indriyani. Nirujya bhaktya swagurum pranamya. What this verse is doing is now it's going to teach you how to meditate. In fact, these three verses, the first one just tells you like to sit in a place where you're alone, Vivekta Desha, right? With a comfortable asana, in a comfortable asana, with an external, I'm going to go through this a lot next week, so I'll just tell you in English what it means. Comfortable asana. Within a space that is both externally and internally pure, so we'll go through that. We just started on that today. With your body, head and neck in line, in a straight line. Abiding in that sannyasa ashrama. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Mentally. Okay. Having all of the indriyas under control, and having, with devotion, done pranams to your teacher. That's the verse. Then that's the setup, and then we'll start going through all of the things that you're going to meditate on. So this would be really nice. I'm going to do a thoroughly spend a lot of time just on the whole meditation process in these three verses. So we'll go through all of it. So, just stop there.
Om Shanti Shanti Shanti. Hari Om Shri Guru Pyo Namaha. Hari Om.
During the meditation, I felt very blessed having the sense organs in the body and the mind. That was very well done.
They appreciate it too. You know, just like, and I think plants do, even in inanimate objects, I feel, you know, they receive that energy. But your body and mind and sense organs receive it, and it, they appreciate it. Makes a huge difference.
Yeah.
The unconscious also, to address the unconscious that way.
That's what I was noticing.
Yeah.
So the I notion that's turned towards the body mind complex, right? Identified with it.
Identified, yes.
Right. It then turns around, and the I notion turns, is absorbed by the self.
Yeah, in the sense that I used to kind of use, I don't know if this works or not, but I used to kind of use this example. It's like you have this, the I notion comes up, like I, here it is, I, and then it lands on the body. Or I lands on the mind, or lands on the mood. Or it lands on something.
Connect. Or the name.
Yeah. Right. But for jnani, the I notion lands on the self. That's where it resides. The ahankar resides with the atma. Not with the upadhi. If it's residing with the upadhi, it's only a mitya. But the sense of self for the ahankara, which is now not really a ahankara, but the aham, the word aham, labels you, not the body. For Nagyani, the aham, the I, labels the body as a conscious being. If they're one thing, the existent conscious body. That's the I, right? Or for the mind, it labels I, the conscious being, and the mind. That's what the I falls on. So it's going to fall on the mind, which then is the conscious being. Or it's going to fall on the body, which is the conscious being. But for jnani, the I labels me, which is always the same. It sits with me. There, that superimposition isn't there. Right? So now the I comes and goes...
I've heard the analogy that a home car becomes like a burnt rope. It, you know, looks like a rope, but if you touch it.
Yeah. That's what we mean by the nitya. It doesn't hold, it doesn't have any power. Now, because the ahamkara, as a product of ignorance, is so powerful. I mean, that is the reality. That's the reality you're living in, even though it's not true. But that doesn't matter. It's like, that's why they use the rope snake example. If you see a rope as a snake, you are seeing the snake, responding to the snake, having the emotions of the snake. You know, there's no snake there. Your ahamkara is the same way. And it's inside.
But that sense of me still remains with the body, even though you know it's not true. I mean, the sense of me is still...
Well, it's different, though. The sense of me, there's nowhere that the sense of me is not. As long as in the entirety of your experience, there is nothing that's away from me. Because, in fact, I'm the truth of all of it. But what you recognize is the stability of your own sense, of your own me, right? But it's not that the body doesn't enjoy me, because you've got a sukshma sharira, you've got a subtle body that's reflecting the self, and so definitely this enjoys me. It doesn't become like a rug. You know, the sense that I doesn't extend out to the space in terms of the subtle body, right? But in another sense, in another way, this whole room, like right now, that we're proceeding through our sense organs, equally enjoys me. Right? Because there's nothing away from me, the conscious being. But there's a difference in terms of, like, the sense of touch, for instance. The sense of touch doesn't pervade the room. The sense of sight pervades the room. The sense of hearing pervades the room. The sense of taste doesn't pervade the room. Sense of smell pervades the room. Yeah, but that the sense of touch doesn't is significant. That's what allows me to feel contained in this body. You know, but say you didn't have a sense of touch, you only had a sense of sight. then the eyes are in this body. And so, you know, there's a lot of things to root you to the body. But if you're just looking at your experience, in fact, in this room, included in the experience is not just external of the body, included in your experience of the room is this physical body. It's also experienced by the same five sense organs, right? And included in your experience is any perceptions by the sense organs, any thoughts that are moving through, they're also experienced right now. You know, any moods or emotions, any fantasies, whatever is experienced, right? All of them, the entirety of your experience is pervaded by me, by awareness. There's nothing that's not away from the subject, the conscious being. And so once you understand that, you start the Dehatma Buddhi. This Dehatma Buddhi means where the notion of the self being the body, it starts getting clipped. You realize that your presence isn't really, me isn't contained at all. It's not that it's pervasive or non-pervasive. It's free of, it's not spatial. You are, but you are not spatial. Just like if I ask you to kind of close your eyes and think of a meadow, the meadow is spatial. It has dimension, right? It has an up and a down, breadth and depth, right? So it has extension, we say. But the extension belongs to the imagination, not to the self from whom the imagination comes. From the standpoint of the self in reference to conscious being, in reference to the imagination, there's no extension, there's no dimension, there's just pure being, you know? And so it's not big or small. It's free of dimension. It's non-dual. And so dimension then, so now say that dimension comes in terms of the Maya, and then now from the individual, the subjective Maya that projects that imagination. Within the imagination, there's dimension. And then you're identified with a character within the imagination, looking around within it, and there's, you know, all of this dimension. But now, you pull yourself back, you realize that all of the dimension, including the individual within it, is contained in the imagination, not the conscious being from which the imagination comes. But the conscious being that you are, which is the source of the imagination, is pervasive in the truth of the imagination. There's no place in the imagination where the set chit, the conscious being, is not. The conscious being is the very clay of the pot. Right? It's the truth. It's the clay of the pot. It's the truth of all of the names and forms in the imagination. This is our situation here. This is Ishwara. Ishwara's imagination, manifest knowledge, in which this body, mind, sense organs are a part. The self, which is myself, is Ishwara's self. There's only one self, and it's non-dimensional. So, the self, which is the truth of your imagination, that non-dimensional self, it is that non-dimensional self that is the truth of the universe. It's not that there's a bigger self. It's the truth of the universe and a little self that's the truth of the imagination. There's only one non-dimensional self, which is non-dual. That's the truth of every aspect of the creation. The creation is the samashti, the total, or the vishti, the individual. All the way through, the same self, if we take a microbe, the self of the microbe is the same self as the self of Ishwara. Right? So non-dimensional. It's not big or small.
So this sense of me that I'm having now is what you're talking about. I mean,
yeah.
It's this very me is that.
The very me that is present to all experience, but itself is not objectified in the subject-object relationship.
Mm-hmm.
If you can objectify yourself, yourself is self-evident, conscious being. You don't need to objectify consciousness. It's just that you are your own experience. Right? So normally this me is taken to be, is superimposed on something I objectify.
Yeah, that's wrong.
That's the problem.
Yeah.
Then you take on the limitations of the objectification. What you have to see is that self is the truth of the objectification, but it's free of the objectification. That's the satya mitya. Yeah. And then when that finished, when you see that, then you're the me, your sense of me is not a contained me. It's not contained, you just have to notice that.
That's so hard to get a handle on, though. I mean, you know, when you unfold it, I can see that, but me feels contained, or...
That's why, you know, I think one gets clear, it's like this: these feelings of containment get clipped.
Mm-hmm.
And I also think that the knitted dhyasana contemplation is helpful. And that's what we're going to spend go into detail on now.
Okay.
Yeah, because on knitted dhyasana, all. See, with knitted dhyasana means where the subject of contemplation is your being. That's knitted dhyasana. It's the self, which is Brahman. Upasana means, because there's dhyana. Dhyana means meditation. Meditation can be knitted dhyasana, where the self is the object of the contemplation, or it can be upasana, where a deity or something, an object, is the object of contemplation. We're going to talk about both. But we're going to focus now on knitted dhyasana, and there are a lot of things to understand in terms of creating a space, a contemplative space. We worked on that today in the meditation. The things we spent time on doing today, in terms of evoking that inner friend and that type of thing, that becomes something that you can do in 1 second. That'll become how you are. You don't need to be in meditation for that. That will become how you are. But first, until it's how you are, it's natural to your mind that inner friend is the inner stance that is natural to your mind. We do that. We take some time in meditation, you know, to develop that attitude. I don't think it takes that long to develop that attitude, because it's so much better than the other one. Really, yeah.
I'm curious, is there anything special about the color orange that the sannyasis choose there?
I don't know. Sometimes it's like the fire of knowledge, and so orange is the color. Swamiji said that before. It's the color of fire, because we often equate knowledge to the burning away of ignorance. So that's the only thing I know. There might be something else, but that's the only thing I've heard him say. Fire of knowledge.
So the primary problem that Anyani has is the misidentification that the ahamkara is actually the body. Yeah.
Well, I mean, sucks you into duality. If that identification wasn't there, you would just be Ishwara. Mm-hmm. See, but the problem is, of course, is that there's a natural ajnanam, that anything that's a part to the whole, any samashti means the whole, upadi, the whole manifest knowledge is the samashti, means the total aggregate. The vyashti is the part. So a part of the aggregate that has sense organs, limited mind, is going to be subject to the whole. Limited. That ajnanam is a limitation. And it has to be, now that has to be removed. For Ishwara, the Lord is not a limitation, because it's just manifest infinite knowledge. So there's no problem at all. There's no identification with anything within it. But then everything within it, you know, all the beings that are reflecting consciousness, that have subtle bodies, then they're all going to say, I am the conscious being, I'm the conscious being. And I'm subject to death. And I'm subject to all kinds of problems, you know. And where's my Ananda? It's out there. It's a bouncing ball into hell, really. Yeah, it's amazing.
So consciousness, so I can get clear about this. So consciousness reflects differently in different. Depending on the material sort of makeup of the object.
Yes, that's why even in the Taittiriya, going to settle, you know, in the Taittiriya Upanishad, something we're doing on Saturday, going to settle in subtler levels of upadis, right? The subtle body, the mind is enjoying less agitation, you know?
But I mean, like for inanimate objects, consciousness reflects.
You need a sukshma sharira.
Uh-huh.
You need a subtle body for consciousness to be reflected.
Hmm.
You need let's put it this way. You need sattva. At the sattva rajas and tamas. That's why in the whole sattva, if the maya is made, the maya, which is the apparent creative material, so I'm just doing this for some of you who might not know these terms. The apparent creative material is made of these three strands. They're called guna, sattva, rajas, and tamas. Sattva is that material that reflects consciousness. Rajas is the active principle, and tamas is the inert principle. So, but these strands are interwoven. They're all pervasive. I mean, rajas goes all through the creation, tamas goes all through the creation, sattva goes through the entire creation. So for Hiranyagarbha, or for the whole manifest knowledge, Ishvara, Ishvara's identification is with that infinite buddhi, which is sattva, the sattva, not with any object within, because the identification is with the whole infinite creation. But for the jivas, the sattva in the jivas and the individuals are limited because identified also with the rajas and tamas. The sattva, rajas and tamas, right? The mind, my mind is different from your mind, and so it has parameters.
But what I mean is the book, I mean, if everything is Brahman, ultimately, then inanimate objects also are sat-chit, right?
Yes, everything is sat-chit, right. But remember, sat-chit is not a knower. Consciousness is not a knower.
Right.
It's just consciousness.
Yes.
And so for there to be knowership in this world of subject-object, knower-known, you need a sukshma sharira, you need a subtle body, right? And so the book or the rug doesn't have its own subtle body, and so it is known, and from the Ishwara drishti, from the Ishwara's vision, the whole thing is known, right? It's knowledge, it's all known. But for these things that are all known, for them in their own right to be a knower, they have to have a subtle body. It's just like when you dream, the whole thing is known to you. You identify with the whole sattva. The whole thing reflects consciousness, the whole dream. Then there are objects in the dream from their own position. They are only known. There are other objects that are knowers, like the jivas, the individuals, the animals, even the plants to a more limited degree. Right? Because they have subtle bodies. Subtle bodies reflect awareness. And so it's because we have subtle bodies, we have the problem. If you're just a book, and a subtle body, that's because there's a subtle body, there's the experience, you know, of consciousness without knowing what consciousness is.
Mm-hmm.
Consciousness of a conscious being without knowing what the conscious being is. And so your mind, for instance, as long as your mind is never without consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as long as the mind is awake, I mean, as long as you're awake, that mind has consciousness. Right, so why shouldn't it say, I'm a conscious being? Because it always has consciousness. As long as this body is alive, it has consciousness, it exists. Why shouldn't it say, I am a conscious existing being? Because it is, right? It is, it just doesn't, but it thinks that it is responsible for that consciousness. When it dies, the consciousness will die.
But doesn't the mind do that as well, because sort of its job is to label and figure things out, and so it just it's just
automatic.
Yeah.
It's automatic, and the ignorance is automatic too. Yeah, it goes about labeling everything. Labels me. Of course, because I'm the one that's always here. That's the ahankara. It's the biggest label, but you know, like I'm the this I is the number one label, and it's unfortunately mislabeled. And so Swamiji will joke sometimes, it's like the infinite you becomes finite by this little mislabel. I mean, it's quite a big
a lot of our identification is through our senses, so
It's a huge thing to lose one's sight or to lose one's hearing.
Oh, yeah.
But in the senses themselves, their essence is considered sattvic.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. The sense organs are sattva and the mind. The mind has the four aspects they talk about, and then the buddhi, the ahankara, the chitta. Buddhi is the intellect, ahankara, the eye notion, chitta, the memory, and manas, the mind. Mind where the emotions are and the fluctuating mood. But that's all that is sattva.
And among the five senses, the hearing is considered actually the most
subtle.
The most subtle.
Well,
and of course you hear the knowledge.
Most subtle in it's a little different than that. The space, akasha, and the space, air, fire, water, earth. Each one of those elements is the most subtle is space, and then from that is the air, and from that is fire, and from that is water, and then earth is the most gross. And the reason for that is going backwards. If you take the earth, it can be perceived by all five sense organs. You can smell it, you can taste it, you can touch it, you can see it, you can hear it. All five sense organs have access to earth. But if you go up one to water, then water has no smell. Smell is given to the earth. It's because earth and water will give water smell, but water itself has no scent. And so one sense organ is missing there that has access to water. All the other four, with water you can taste it, you know, you can see it, you can feel it, you can hear it rippling. So it's one up in subtlety because we don't have access of all five senses. But if you go up one more to fire, fire has no taste or smell. So now you've lost another sense organ. Fire, you can see it, you can touch it, you can hear it, but you can't taste it or smell it. Then you go up one more to air, you lose sight. Right? So air, you can't smell air, that belongs to earth. You can't taste air, that belongs to water. You can't see air. Right? So now you can only feel air and you can hear it, you know, the wind blowing. Now you go up to space, right? And you can't feel space. Right? The only quality they'll give to space is sound, because sound travels through space. It requires space for sound for sound to be. And so in that way they say that space is the most subtle and sound is a guna, a quality of space. And so in that way.
When they talk about air, I would get a little confused
wind.
Between air and space, because sometimes like they seem the same thing to me.
No,
but
because
air is wind.
Yes.
Is that what it means?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. Exactly.
You can correlate it to the states of matter, it would be a gas, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like a physical property that's subtle. In terms of a subtle body, what about a murti?
A form?
Well, you know, like a...
Murti means form.
Sorry, I mean like a statue.
Yeah.
You know, like a, you know, a statue
that we pray to.
Because I have a Shiva statue in my house now. I'm doing puja. So, you know, obviously it doesn't have a subtle body.
Well, actually a murti,
yeah.
A murti, in fact, we have to be careful that the murti stays that we have at home stays within a small size or else you have to be very careful that the pujas that you do are proper. But when a murti is installed in a temple, you're actually evoking this, in a sense, a subtle body into the murti.
Mm-hmm.
There are a lot of rituals that are being done there that you're evoking some sort of vital force into the murti.
Yeah.
And that's why once you do that, the rituals and chants and everything that are done, they have to be maintained.
Mm-hmm.
You know? But for us, what we do, say like it's like I have my Ganesha and different, but they're all appropriate size, so it's considered safe to have them. But then you just use those for upasana, because I'm these certain deities that I have, my pictures and whatnot, just because they mean something to me. And I have Bokishwar in those forms, and I have attachment to them. Bhagawan in those forms.
Right.
Yeah. We'll talk about that. We're going to, after we do these next few verses, they do the saguna Brahma Upasana, where we do evokes in this verse, it'll evoke in Shiva and get informed that why we do that and how that's helpful.
I thought the mind had all three gunas, not just sattva. But that's how the everybody's mind is different, right?
Sukshma Sharira does have all the gunas, but the mind can be contaminated by rajas and tamas.
Right.
And we can also say that, but the mind itself is sattva.
Mm.
It can be contaminated by rajas and sattva. And that's why, like in the, I guess the 14th, 15th, and even 16th chapters of the Gita, they talk about quite a bit, oh, his mind is sattvic. The brahmana's mind is sattvic. Means that it enjoys the qualities of shanti and of tejas and of reflecting. So it has those qualities. It's not being associated with rajas.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but the mind can get identified and associated with rajas. So we'll say that person's rajasic. But if you go into the actual material of the mind, it's the sattvic element, subtle element of the five elements.
Mm.
And then of course you've got the karmendriyas, the organs of action, and the pranas, those are the rajasic element of the five subtle elements. Then you have the tamas element, tamas aspect of the five elements, subtle elements that go through this process of becoming five-fold to become this physical body. So we're looking at the mind being, and we say that this body is sattvic, means that, you know, you're eating sattvic food and, you know, living a sattvic life, there's a sattvic disposition, that type of thing. Food is sattvic, rajas and tamas.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Different types of work are sattvic, rajas, sattva, rajas and tamas, like that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And you need them all.
Yeah, we do. If you need, otherwise, if you don't have the rajas, you won't.
Yeah.
You won't be able to move. You don't have the tamas, you won't have a body. But you don't want to be tamasic.
Right.
You know, if tamasic means that you're. If we talk like that, it means that you know, you're dull and slovenly. If you're rajasic could be you have a lot of energy. Could also be you're irritable and angry. You know, and also power driven. So it just depends on how you're talking. But then if you demonize rajas or sattva, then you're kind of not understanding how the terms are used.
Demonize,
like saying, if you take tamas as a guna to mean slovenly and dull-witted and ignorant, then you're not appreciating that they're just using that as a quality and not the guna. We're not talking about the guna tamas or the guna rajas or the guna tamas.
Mm-hmm.
That can get confusing, actually.
Yeah.
If you don't know, if you don't understand.
Yeah. I saw this bumper sticker this week. I thought it was pretty good. It was a bumper sticker that says, "When power of love overtakes the love of power, only then will we have peace."
That's nice. When the power of love overtakes the love of power,
mm-hmm.
only then will we have peace. That's good.
Yeah.
Now, should we stop?